Originally, I think this talk was going to be given by Dr. Ken Kassman, who had other obligations. I think he might be talking at the same time someplace else, and he asked if I could do this. Ken had been talking. He would be talking about land use change and things like that. That's not the area I really work in, so I decided I would reflect on some of my own thoughts regarding annual crops and water quality, and in addition to that, add a little bit on what I've been thinking about in terms of the whole trying to account and weigh things like water quality against greenhouse gas emissions, and trying to equate apples to apples and come to terms with some accounting. So, if you attended the first symposium on the topic yesterday morning, Jeff Valenik gave a talk on physiological efficiencies in plants, and I think the one of the take-home messages in that talk was that without a fundamental change in how plants do their thing physiologically, the end requirement is going to scale to a certain degree with dry matter. And so unless we do something fundamentally different in terms of what's in the plant and how the plant operates, we are not going to get twice as much dry matter with half as much nitrogen. And as we go forward and think about, well, we want to grow more, that's going to likely mean more reactive nitrogen out there, and therefore increased environmental consequences, including water quality. And if you think about it from the quantitative perspective, the devil's in the details. It's all about the math and how you tote things up. And this is a nice illustration, I think, from a Erisman 2010 paper that looks at the nitrous oxide side of the equation and simply shows, depending on whether you're doing a conservative calculation or a more liberal calculation, it has a dramatic effect on how much nitrogen you can add before you cross and are no longer have a smaller carbon footprint. That's all that's shown in that graph, but I think it illustrates the devil is in the details regarding math. Oh, I guess I have a... if you look at projections for impacts on water quality that were made prior to us getting all excited about using crops for bioenergy and thinking about the environmental consequences of doing that, not surprisingly, the estimates of what's going to be exported in fields was going up. I mean, there's no question about that. The forecast made in 2002 said that essentially, unless we change how we farm, biofuel aside, bioenergy crops aside, we will continue to increase the amount of nitrogen that's getting exported in rivers to the coasts. And so that leaves us kind of with this question about if we're going to think both about water quality and greenhouse gas emissions at the same time and try to optimize this, and then think about it within the context of carbon neutrality, we have to have some way of doing equivalence. And we have a system of equivalence for gases amongst the gases, but we don't have a system of equivalence between nitrate in water and nitrous oxide in the atmosphere, or where nitrous oxide is emitted. Does it matter if it's emitted from a stream versus a field, and how do you think about that? So we have a problem of equivalency that we're going to have to solve if we want to move along. And so that kind of got me to thinking about what's happened to the evolution of our thinking about how do you select a crop as a bioenergy source. And initially, I think our thinking was pretty simple. You selected a choice based on some kind of analysis of carbon footprint and the net energy balance, and it was pretty simplistic. If as long as the net energy balance was greater than the energy that you used to grow the stuff, it was probably okay. And you took into consideration the carbon footprint of the thing, then you chose the crop. That was the simple approach. Now we've gotten to the point where we're thinking much more broadly, and at a minimum, we're not only considering the net energy balance, but we're looking at the concept of energy self-sufficiency. We care where the energy comes from, and we'd like it to come from the U.S., if you're in the U.S. And then we have this notion that we're not quite sure what to do about, but we'd like to have a global, kind of a global optimization of all the ecosystem services that are involved. And this, if you break this down, what this looks like is the energy self-sufficiency agenda kind of requires you that not only the net energy balance be positive, it's not just compared to petroleum, and that the carbon emitted be less than the carbon emitted from an alternate source. But that you add these additional sustainability items. And among them is this notion of you don't want to negatively impact the food supply. In fact, per unit land base, you'd like to see the food supply go up, maybe by something like 1.03, you know, a factor of 1.03 compounded annually or something like that. And that would give you a good notion. And then at the same time, you'd also like the ecosystem services, whatever they may be, to be greater when you do this crop A versus an alternate source, where your ecosystem, for a certain number of ecosystem services, there's some to a net positive. And if you're looking at it specifically, you're solving for a net positive of yield, carbon sequestration, all kinds of things we really don't have a good handle on. And the other important thing to remember that we don't know much about is that each of these services itself is some function of genetics and management, both of which are undergoing constant improvement. And then the environment, which is highly variable, constantly changing, and is itself a function of the ecosystem services that you decide to deliver to a certain extent. So definitely a mess if you're thinking about trying to solve for something. And so you can then think, okay, so for some of these annual crops, we have quite a lot of knowledge. And we have quite a lot of knowledge about carbon and nitrogen. So what if we kind of back it up and say, okay, we know something about carbon and nitrogen. Let's see if we can solve the ecosystem service equation. If we just consider carbon and nitrogen, water, soil, atmosphere, can we do it? Because if we can't do it there, we can't, for an annual crop, we can't do it elsewhere because we, for many reasons. But anyway, we have a long history of carbon-nitrogen research. That includes the empirical studies and the models. We know that nitrogen is a big deal in terms of driving yield and then in terms of the things that we're discussing, greenhouse gas emissions as well as water quality. And then we also have out there some thinking already in terms of N-crediting and in water that is, you know, proceeded, albeit on its own, separately than the N-crediting that has gone on in the greenhouse carbon crediting world, but at least there's a crediting notion out there for water quality. So the rest of what I'm going to do is just tick through a series of problems and trying to solve for why for just carbon, nitrogen, and water. And the first problem is that we don't actually have very many studies that simultaneously look at the soil, air, and water quality. And all I want you to see here is different sizes of the bubbles. The left side is nitrous oxide, the size of the bubble. The right side is the left side is nitrate in drainage water. The right side is nitrous oxide in the atmosphere. You're just looking at a bunch of treatments. You'd like to be near where the arrow is if you're producing lots of biomass, and you'd like the bubble to be tiny. And about all that you can see is that near the arrow, the bubbles are big. Far from the arrow, the bubbles are tiny. And it just kind of illustrates that you need to understand the trade-offs between soil, air, and water as influenced by management if you're going to make any progress towards solving the equation. So solving this, it requires a database that simultaneously looks at these things. And lots of one or two factor studies out there, but three or more factors are harder to find. One of the things that we do know, this is a meta-analysis, not only that nitrogen uptake scales with biomass, but when you increase the rate of N applications out there, you not only increase the N loss, you're looking at multiple pathways. And what I want you to see there is that as you increase the application rate and input on the x-axis, you increase the variation. So our knowledge for higher rates, you have higher variations, and that's going to impact the certainty with which we can solve these equations. All right, problem number two, and I'm not really supposed to be talking about some of these novel perennials, but everything is in comparison. So in comparison, when we look at something like corn versus something like miscanthus, we know a lot about corn, a lot less about miscanthus. And in this case, I'm just showing this table came out this summer. And what you see circled are the nitrogen requirements. And you can see corn at the top has a fairly hefty nitrogen requirement. But something like miscanthus, which is third from the bottom, they're saying has a requirement of 0 to 15. All right, well, we know a lot about corn. We know things like, we know this is back in the 1970s, Dave Mengel data. We know things about the amount of N that has to be taken up per unit root, and it's really high when the plant is small, per unit root length. We also know that's the size of the bubble. We also know that when the requirement of uptake for the plant is maximized. Again, it's at some point, and we adjust it within the growth. It's not at maximum biomass or maximum mean root length. And we take that into consideration in the recommendations that are out there. We know a lot. Some of the other annuals that we are beginning to think about, like sorghum, maybe do better in terms of N uptake. This is just some of our data. You're looking at maize, which is the red dot, and then three different sorghums. One is a high biomass photoperiod sensitive, one's a commercial hybrid, the light blue, and then one's a sweet sorghum. And all I wanna show here is that if you're looking at something other than grain, these things do better, and they do better at a lower N rate than at no N, the biomass is a lot higher, and then at a first increment, they seem to level out, and it all seems very promising. Corn continues to require more nitrogen. But what I'd like to, you know, this got me thinking about what's the knowledge penalty in comparative assessments? And I think we tend to, if we're looking at our enthusiasm for something, we can certainly point to reasons. If we have a lot of data, if we know a lot about a crop, we can identify reasons why it's not a good idea. The less we know, it seems, the more enthusiastic we tend to be. So we actually have less data on switchgrass or something like these sorghums that have potential. They seem good, and we're really enthusiastic. If you look at something like miscanthus, we're really, really enthusiastic, and we're pretty sure you can grow it with almost no nitrogen. But there are data out there to suggest that that's not a great idea. This is the some of the data from a long-term, the 10 or 11-year experiment in England on miscanthus. And it's just simply a net energy balance. And that's what is circled. And you can see that if you don't apply that zero N rate, your net energy balance for nitrogen over time is going to be negative into the soil plant system. If you apply 60 kg per hectare, you almost break even, and if you apply 120, well then you have a net input over this 10-year time period. So that ought to be a lesson that we consider against, history for other crops, including annuals. And these are data from Iowa. It goes back to the 1920s. Simply illustrate that you can significantly deplete soil organic carbon by growing crops, removing the yield, and not fertilizing. And that's what you see there. 60 years of cropping, and you see as much as over a 25% reduction in soil organic carbon. You go back and you start adding fertilizer, including just nitrogen, which is the little triangle there, and you can recover. So 2 points, the need for long-term studies to actually see what's going on, and that when you study these things, you got to study all the parameters. You've got to study not just the soil organic carbon, but what's the impact. You're losing soil organic carbon. In all likelihood, you're certainly losing stored nitrogen. And what does that look like in terms of water quality? All right, another problem. This is a common one, standardized methods. We can all measure things, but we can't necessarily equate them to each other and aggregate the data if we don't really carefully describe what we're doing. And the data aren't useful together if we don't have a common approach. And all I'm showing to you here is some data to illustrate that if you're going out and doing a grab sample out of a tile line, the time at which you collect that sample is going to could significantly impact the concentration that you measure. If you go out in the first rainfall after you've applied manure and you get some of that first flow, in this case you could sample as much as 50 ppm concentration in the drainage water. If you go out later on during that same, that the x-axis is minutes, you're going to sample a lot less. And so this notion of how, when, where, and what a number means, and an agreement so that we can aggregate data, is one of those questions I think that that we're struggling with. There's a lot of discussion now about it, but no resolution. And I think it's really important when we're thinking about water quality to understand what we're going to measure and how we're going to measure it, and have some agreement on baseline measurements, much the way GraceNet has agreement on greenhouse gases. Last couple problems, scaling. We all know this is a problem. Is what you measure at the field going to tell you what's going on at the landscape scale? In this case, you're just simply looking at how much flow, drainage flow volume drives the load loss. If you care about the load loss, is it more important to understand the concentration versus the hydrology and the flow volume? So I just added in there another thing that's kind of difficult to get your head around, is that politically, when you look at water quality problems versus air quality problems, water quality tend to be downstream and managed within a local watershed. Airsheds, everybody's contributing to, the management zone is somewhat different. All right, wrap up. Earth system scales. This is not my area, but extending it a little bit further. Really nice kind of summary of reactive nitrogen and where it goes. And I just put it up here to show that's the red, and it's going, you know, it leaves the field, it goes into the stream, it goes into the ocean. As we go down scale from the field, we know less and less, and the measurements have bigger and bigger uncertainties associated with them, and it makes it very difficult to do this toting up. Last point, data. We are all collecting a lot of data. Those of us that work in this area at the field scale, we are not very good about keeping, curating, preserving, and making available our data. And this really hampers synthesis, and it's hampering synthesis greatly in the water quality area. So Indrajit Chaubey just published a paper on needs for water quality research, and the number one need is data for scaling to landscape scale. So data, and that's my last point. If you think about bioenergy production, what matters? Yield. What matters for LCA and ecosystem service evaluation, equating water quality, folding in water into the carbon footprint analysis, it's data. And that's it.
We have time for one question.
Okay, so the question, as I understand it, is that everything really takes off when you go into an end surplus situation. So I think the debate, and it's certainly a key debate for some of these candidate or emerging species for which we don't have much data, what is the surplus application? Because Miscanthus, where there's a recommendation that 15 kg per hectare is sufficient, in terms of N per unit biomass in a plant, has more midsummer than corn does. So the question then becomes, if you're going to grow a stand, and it's one of those topics that's debated, how much do you need, and you're removing, how much do you need to supplement with it? Is it just a balance where we have lots of excess water pushing through, we lose some every year? Even for those crops that were well studied on, we can say, an optimal or an average N rate that will meet the balance is 160 pounds per acre for corn or something like that. But as soon as that comes out of my mouth, there will be a debate about whether that is the right rate or not. So one of the questions I've been asked recently is, after 50 years of N research, how come we're still debating the rate? And I think there's a valid point there we can discuss, but there's no such thing as a leak-free system. You make things productive by giving them enough, and typically that means a little bit more than they're actually going to need just to make sure in the ecological way, but not a lot more in the insurance perspective from the way we used to think about farm management.